So good morning. It's really a lovely morning. The New York Times predicted this would be a seasonable day. I loved that phrase. I want to welcome the students of interpreting today. Both of you, welcome to us. And if you watch Manchin carefully, you may learn something about interpreting of the Dharma. Some new words, perhaps, for you. So this morning paper, oh my. I'm afraid that I'm still a person that picks up the morning paper every morning and sits there on my doorstep at about 5:15. I hear it pop down. You know, I want to connect to the world that I live in. And I'm old-fashioned, so that's the way I do it, rather than in the many other possible ways that come at me all day long on my electronic devices. I still have this paper. And I recognize that the world that the newspaper presents to me is not the world. It's just the world that the newspaper presents to me. And when I say the newspaper, I betray my localism here in New York, New York Times. And when I look at the headlines, you know, I wince. It's kind of painful. It usually is painful. So it's amazing that I do it every morning. Huh? All the suffering that is reported, the poverty, the violence, the disasters, ecological and ordinary. And then, you know, I kind of like put the paper down and reflect on my own personal suffering and of the people around me, people in this room, people in this community, illness, loss, old age, anger. So whether it's a structural violence I'm looking at, or the innocence of an infected tick that causes suffering, there's no end to it. There's no end to it. The suffering that we can witness if we open our eyes. And certainly when I sit in the Dokzan room and listen to my Dharma students, I hear a sense of being overwhelmed by the suffering. The suffering of the world and the personal suffering. And being overwhelmed, we don't know what to do. We may freeze. We may resist. And then we begin to feel defeated by life itself. What does it feel like, this overwhelm? Like waves, I always think of it as a wave crashing over my head, this overwhelming sense. Fukushima, it's very troubling if you follow what's going on in Japan right now. Hunger, overflowing prisons, people wearing guns to the coffee shop. People wearing guns to school. and also in our own families, having an angry teenager, one of the most difficult passages of life. One's own addictions, a toxic work environment, a sleepless night. It feels so overwhelming. And so naturally the question is, what we ask ourselves is, what does the Dharma teach us about this feeling of being overwhelmed? To me, this word overwhelming calls to mind a line from Dogen's Uji, as it is translated in an early translation by Kaz Ta-Nehisi. He says, overwhelming overwhelms overwhelming and sees overwhelming. I like that. Very Dogen-esque. Maybe a little Gertrude Stein thrown in there. What is the antidote for feeling overwhelmed? Dogen's sequence goes on. Overwhelming overwhelms overwhelming and sees overwhelming. Overwhelming is nothing but overwhelming. This is time. As overwhelming is caused by you, there is no overwhelming that is separate from you. Thus, you go out and meet someone. Someone meets someone. So now it's very clear, and I can end the talk. I always pull that line when I'm quoting Dogen, because it's difficult to get to his point. But I think what he's doing is he's normalizing our experience of feeling overwhelmed. Overwhelming is nothing but overwhelming. This is time. Or we could say, and if you knew the whole fascicle, you would be able to say this more clearly, this is life. And you could even say, this is me. Overwhelming is nothing but overwhelming. This is me. Overwhelming is nothing but overwhelming. This is life. Our actual life, no matter what. To avoid it, to hide from it, to resist what is right here, is to separate from ourselves, from our time, from our reality, from just this. We have no agency until we recognize what we're in. Before that, we're either frozen or lost. It's a denial and resistance to the soup that we're in. Overwhelmed. I remember once, and some of you may have heard me tell this story before, but it's so illustrative of this point. I went to with some friends. I was in my 20s. I went with some friends to the Stanislaus River area in Northern California. And there's a huge aqueduct there, which carries water from one region to the next. And sometimes it carries it through a canal, and sometimes through these structures, these kind of bridge-like structures filled with water. And the speed of the flow is amazing because it's just coming down from all these mountains. And it is a natural place to go tubing, to jump in and go rush down the rivers in inner tubes. And I had never experienced tubing before, although I'm a good swimmer, I had never had that kind of inland experience. We got out of the truck, and the truck went away, and everybody jumped in, and I was like, ah! I looked down, and it's like this churning white water, you know, moving so fast. It was just very scary. Very scary. And I just kind of stood there with my inner tube. And water was moving so fast that already my friends were out of sight. And the truck, you know, the dust of the wheels. I'm standing on a bridge by myself. So finally, you know, no choice, I jumped in. And it was more tumultuous than I even ever imagined. It was like this. And very, very scary. And I looked up, and there was a tree that was kind of like over the channel, a willow. And I grabbed at a branch to just stop everything, you know, just get out of here. So the water is churning. And I'm in a tube, and I grab a branch. What happens? I stop. The water doesn't stop. The inner tube doesn't stay around my waist, right? It immediately, you know, goes to my feet, and I put my feet apart to hold it, because I know that if I don't have the tube, I'm really lost. And I am frozen, paralyzed. How long did it take me to hear a little quiet voice inside? Let go. Let go. And I let go. The tube comes back on my waist. I'm on top of the water. I'm moving down the canal. I'm able to go to the right or to the left or do what I want because I'm now in the river, in the motion. What a profound lesson. What a profound lesson. I mean, I didn't get it at that point, you know, 20 years later. I said, what was it? What happened then? My body realized that the only way to survive the situation was to be where I was. To not be in my idea of stopping everything, that's impossible. Just like it's impossible for us to be in a perfect world. We ain't in a perfect world. Being in the water, I could steer. Being in the water, I had some agency. I could flow along with what was reality for me at that moment. As Dogen says, as overwhelming is caused by you, there is no overwhelming that is separate from you. Thus, you go out and meet someone. Someone meets someone. In this case, the someone was the swiftly flowing water. Before, it was a frozen idea. My inevitable acceptance of my situation, going out and meeting someone, meeting the water. Meeting the recognition that I was not separate from the stream. Meeting my reality in that moment. Grabbing the branch might be fine on land, but doesn't work in swiftly flowing water. So how does that apply to us today? How are we able to meet our own personal overwhelm? Do we distract ourselves from it? Pretend like it's not happening? Do we stiffen or hide from that overwhelming? From the flow of our lives? What would it be like to realize our vastness, our whole self, our whole life, our relationship to the whole of time, to the whole of space? To look at the stars and to recognize ourselves. Would we be so overwhelmed that we couldn't function? Or would we be inspired to generosity and compassion? Maybe that's what Shakyamuni Buddha saw on that pivotal night when he recognized the truth that he'd been seeking for all those many years. I'm thinking about Shakyamuni Buddha a lot because, you know, we quote him all the time, and of course we have actually nothing written. So it's kind of like, it's beautiful, really, because we have things that were written 400 or 500 years later attributed to him. So all this great wisdom we can take in without over-idealizing it. And the particular version of his enlightenment experience that we as Zen people listen to and think about was written by a Japanese master, one of Dogen's students, Keizan Zenji. So in his version, Shakyamuni Buddha had sat in Zazen all night. Since it's a Zen story, he's in Zazen. And he looks up at Venus, the morning star. He has this experience. And he says, "How wonderful, how marvelous. I, the great earth, and all sentient beings are simultaneously enlightened." Isn't that an amazing statement? Not just me, but all sentient beings are simultaneously enlightened. And Keizan, who was, as I said, a successor of Dogen's, asks, "Who is this I that says I and the great earth and all sentient beings are enlightened?" And he answers, "This so-called I is not Shakyamuni Buddha, and Shakyamuni Buddha also comes from this I." What does that mean? So isn't it that also Shakyamuni Buddha is not the only one speaking? I and the great earth and all beings are simultaneously enlightened. But Shakyamuni Buddha arises out of this I, out of this voice, this limitless wholeness. Almost as if Keizan is showing us something that is really deep and profound. Don't get caught up the idea of Shakyamuni Buddha separate from us. But this Shakyamuni Buddha is us, is all beings throughout space and time speaking. It evokes, you know, Whitman's, "I am vast, I contain multitudes." Rumi's, hearts of boundless oceans without limit. All the mystics who remind us that these ideas of enlightenment are not singular events, but they are about each one of us now. Not 2,500 years ago, but now. This is marvelous. But what I'm curious about is how does that insight that we attribute to Shakyamuni Buddha, how does that help us navigate our own responsibility these days? Our responsibility for the well-being of the world. I, the great earth, and all sentient beings are simultaneously enlightened, interconnects all of us. How does it move you? Kazan explains what he means by this I. He says, just as when you lift up a large net, all the holes are raised. Can you see that? All the holes are raised. In the same way, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. And it was not only all beings on earth that were enlightened, but also all of the Buddhas of past, present, and future at that time attained enlightenment. Nothing is left out. It's difficult to conceive that, isn't it? A reality where nothing is left out. And it's not even about perceiving, but it's about being that. You know, perception is separation, subject and object. I perceive this. These are two separate things. I perceive the churning waters of the Stanislaus Canal, aqueduct. But when I'm in it, I am also the Stanislaus Aqueduct. Not separate. So think about Shakyamuni. You know his story, strenuously seeking insight into his questions of why there is suffering in the world. Stayed up all night, stayed up many days, and all night that one night, with the intention to see clearly. I'm not getting up until I wake up. What a powerful, powerful vow. But the thing is, he wasn't going to get up until he got something that was over there. Something that he didn't have. Something that was separate from him. So you could say that he was feeling different, set apart, unawakened, unenlightened. He was not the same as that which he was seeking. So he had been doing this for many, many years, but something was different that night. Maybe he felt a cool breeze on his face as he looked up. I mean, we don't imagine him sitting like this, so he must have been sitting with his eyes straight or down or closed. But for some reason, he looks up at the morning star as it arises. It's amazing. We don't often get to see it here, but if before you go to bed, some of you and some of us, when we get up in the morning, take a look. The morning star is there, particularly in the winter months, you can see. Happened. He saw it, and it was different than it had ever been. Maybe he had a tear in his eye, a moment of intimacy with the star, a moment of connection. You know, it's not so different from what you may feel at any surprising moment when suddenly there's a tear in your eye. It might be a drop of dew on a leaf. It might be the smile of someone in the subway. Could be anything, a sound. A feeling in your throat. A warmth in your chest. Seeing the morning star is like that. A sudden realization of the wholeness of everything. The wholeness. It could even be a horn. Or watching the shadows on the walls in this city. Some people might think that's corny. But you could say what Shakyamuni Buddha did was kind of corny. So be careful what you dismiss. What he saw, what he felt, what he spoke about was this unity, this relationship with Venus. Everything was awakened at that moment, not just Shakyamuni. The vast, limitless nature of reality was awakened in that moment. I and all sentient beings and the great earth are simultaneously enlightened. It is a profound mystical insight. And what did he do with that realization? How did he respond to that? Was he overwhelmed? Did he go off and retire alone? Go back to the castle? Did he just combust? No. He set out to teach for 45 years after that. Mix it up with people who didn't agree with him, people in great distress, people who were very discouraged. He had set out to find the cause of suffering. To answer the question, when we look at humanity and we see that all of life is attenuated by the reality of sickness, old age, and death, why? Why is there suffering? So when he sat there that night and saw this marvelous, unconstructed reality, reality without concepts, reality that has no edges, that flows. How did that help him? What did he see? What did he see that allowed him and now us to accept our karma? And to accept our responsibility for our karma? Because I am part of the world, I am responsible for the injustice in the world. I am responsible for the terror. I am responsible for the poverty. Yes, I'm also responsible for generosity and goodness and caring. and kindness. But this is what we call emptiness. We are responsible for the whole thing. Emptiness is a terrible word. I think fullness is a much better translation. There is a way to see the world without the categories that we set up. The ideas that we've been conditioned to believe in. We can let them drop. And that's what gives us the power to serve. To work without expecting a particular outcome. Shakyamuni's insight was overwhelming, but not paralyzing. He managed a large group of followers. He raised resources for retreat centers. We never think of that. We never hear about that, but it's in the early sutras. He spoke to political figures to stop the violence and wars during his time. He was not overwhelmed by his insight. It did not impede his functioning in the world. He was not flooded or conquered by the power of his insight. He used it to serve others. He was not overwhelmed. He was not inundated. He saw there is this juicy, wonderful reality right here. Right here, in the midst of our troubles. That's what I think the first overwhelming means in that phrase, overwhelming, overwhelms, overwhelming. The first one is the oceanic flooding of everything, our recognition that we are part of the whole. And what does this overwhelming overwhelm? Our frightened, divisive, ordinary ideas of overwhelming. We can say, oh, the suffering of the world is overwhelming. And I can do nothing. Or we can say, I'm overwhelmed by the demands of my life. And I don't know what to do. But in both cases, there's a kind of paralysis. There's a catching hold of that branch. There's this trying to stop the flow of our lives rather than immersing ourselves in the world of suffering and then beginning to steer our tube. Yes, I'm going to do this. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to help in this. This is the way I can serve. So not a paralysis, not holding on until we drowned onto that branch, but being a part of the flow and at the same time having agency in the flow, knowing when it's right to go in this direction and when it's right to go in that direction. This is what I think Dogen meant when he said, going out to meet someone, you meet someone. Maybe I should be a little more specific. Right now we have awakened awareness of the economic injustice in this country. And people are now willing to talk about it. You know, a few years ago they weren't talking about it. I think it's because of the Occupy movement that took place, what, 2011? 2 years ago, and many people said, oh, it's failed, nothing, it didn't produce anything. But actually, it continually has changed the dialogue in this country and around the world. That's very powerful. It's what Dogen says, as overwhelming is caused by you, there is no overwhelming that is separate from you. Thus, you go out and meet someone. Someone meets someone. You take action. It's not so much that our one particular view or our strategy is the right one, but rather our willingness to engage the world as it is, to practice awareness and interdependence. And that's the juice of the morning star, of recognizing our place in the world, in its history, in its future. My hope is that we will be part of building a society that is not based on separate, selfish, self-interest. And I do think it's possible. I do think we are at a time when it is possible. I would love to see a society that is relational and compassionate, that offers service to everyone. And that's what was so powerful about Shakyamuni's insight 2,500 years ago. He gave us the key. We can amplify that vision. We can amplify that vision by taking responsibility for what we can change. So I encourage you to look carefully at this world that we look at when we open the newspaper and we say, oh, this is overwhelming. But this is my world. This is my life. What can I do? What difference can I make? How can I not be overwhelmed, but rather functional? So let me end with a gatha. Looking up at the morning star, old Shakya was blown away. But he came back and worked his butt off. Thank him by serving someone every day.